Want a chance to win £250 in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be £250 better off.
Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. At the end of October 2025, during a meeting in South Korea, U.S. President Donald Trump and China's President Xi Jinping agreed to postpone China's export controls on rare earths in exchange for U.S. tariff reductions on imports from China. The deal was the culmination of a long-running trade dispute between the U.S. and China, which had been heightened in recent months by President Trump's aggressive rhetoric and increased tariffs. To talk about the current state of U.S.-China relations, I spoke to Scott Kennedy, Senior Advisor and Trustee Chair in Chinese Business and Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and a leading authority on Chinese economic policy and U.S.-China commercial relations. Our conversation covered the U.S.-China deal, the state of relations between the two countries during the first months of the second Trump presidency, and the insights that can be gained by speaking to scholars and experts on the ground in China. I began our conversation by asking Scott Kennedy to outline their research and current work.
I'm Scott Kennedy. I'm with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. And for my entire career, I've been working on China. I look at its economy, its relationship with the rest of the world. And the way I primarily learn about China is jet lag. I get on airplanes. I travel a lot, China and other places. And it's a lot of fun. It's a lot more fun than looking at a computer screen or downloading data, which is important, but I really like to kick the tires, so to speak. And so that's my perspective on how I learn.
Thank you. So we're speaking at the end of October 2025. This morning, it was announced that Donald Trump and Xi Jinping had struck a deal during a meeting in South Korea to postpone China's export controls on rare earths and that the U.S. would reduce tariffs on Chinese imports. Why is this deal important?
In some ways, this deal is very unimportant, and in some ways, it's really important. Let me mention the last first, which is it's important that the U.S. and China reach some kind of deal in South Korea, because if they hadn't, they would have gone over the cliff and continued to escalate in ways that seriously hurt the other, themselves, the global economy. And so they pulled back. And that's important. And so if you're a student of international politics, if you're a policymaker around the world, if you're a business person, then you're breathing a little sigh of relief today that they did that. On the other hand, it's unimportant in that the substance of what they were talking about, these are weighty issues, but the way they engaged them was in the most narrow transactional way possible. That means that they did not solve any of the big problems that they have with each other. They just kicked the can down the road, particularly the United States. The U.S. has for a long time been really worried about Chinese industrial policy. China spends more on industrial policy than anyone else by far. Been really worried about economic security issues, technology leakage, supply chain resilience, a bunch of other things, human rights. Those things were only tangentially addressed today. And China has been basically given a pass to do whatever it wants in any sphere. And so as important as it is to have a temporary pause in the escalation, the problems that the world faces because of U.S.-China tensions haven't gone away. And just like anything, when you stick your head in the sand, sometimes when you take your head out of the sand and start looking at it a little bit later, things may look a little bit worse.
So we're now at about the 9-month mark of Trump's second term. Looking beyond the deal that we've just been talking about, how would you describe China-U.S. relations at this point?
It's kind of hard to say. From the perspective of the Trump administration and the president, he seems to be thrilled. Today's meeting was a 12 out of 10. He seems to have this special bromance with Xi Jinping and is borrowing some of his governance methods with regard to cyber and data and his views about democracy and human rights and things like that. On the other hand, these are two very competitive countries, both extremely powerful. China on the rise the last few decades. China's goal is to make the world safe for countries like China. And the U.S. historically has been trying to defend the rules-based order. And from that perspective, they've been in the strategic competition for a while now. Their level of trust that they have in each other is zero. They wouldn't trust each other with the most rudimentary tasks and expectations. And they see their economic connections with the other as simply a pile of risks, not a beneficial thing. Interdependence for them looks like a horrible thing. And although President Trump and Xi are papering over some of those differences, or at least putting a smile on it for the time being, they're putting lipstick on a pig. And this relationship is going to continue to be dicey, and it's going to continue to affect the rest of the world.
I just want to draw on that point. You said that the U.S.-China relationship is a pile of risks from the perspective of both parties. What are the biggest risks?
So probably LSE students and faculty have read 1977 book Power and Interdependence by Joe Nye and Bob Cohane that talks about the complex challenges of interdependence in the world, what that means for those who have positive relations and those who are adversaries. They presented this in very basic terms about the country that has the trade deficit has an advantage over the one with the trade surplus in terms of leverage. But economic ties go far beyond trade balances these days. There's massive amounts of direct investment, portfolio investment, their global technology value chains. We have a very complex global financial system. We have global challenges like climate and public health. And that interdependence creates opportunities and risks. And for the most part, the leaders of both countries and the dominant view amongst analysts has been that the interdependence you have with a potential adversary simply is risks. I guess the math for that is really simple. Lower the connectivity, increase your security. And I think that's an equation that both sides predominantly believe in. So the economic security challenges include technology leakage, losing your advantage in critical technologies, particularly those with dual use capabilities, supply chain dependence, needing and raw materials and manufactured goods from the other side, like PPE if there's a public health crisis, chemicals used in pharmaceuticals. Then you have data security challenges. Everything collects and transmits data now. A car is a cell phone on wheels. Those all present significant potential risks if the country that you're interdependent with treats you or sees you as an adversary and vice versa. And so figuring out how to manage that interdependence with an adversary is really very, very challenging. And the default answer to reduce connectivity isn't fixing the problem. And so we're struggling for finding alternatives. We've seen some conversation amongst officials within the Trump administration about other ways to think about that connectivity. But for the most part, Washington's default approach is to reduce connectivity, or at least see that connectivity as simply risks and not as national security opportunities.
So China is widely considered to be an authoritarian and an illiberal state. What does the rise of illiberalism globally, and potentially even in the US, mean for US-China relations?
I think the only folks that don't consider China authoritarian are China's leaders, who say that that definition just doesn't actually describe how their system actually works. And it misstates Western systems, multi-party electoral systems, as genuinely providing choice, when in their view, it just provides a rotation of elites with very similar views. But in any case, I think most folks treat and view China as authoritarian, since there's no direct elections for its leaders, nothing even resembling anything like competitiveness. And in multi-party democracies, there are. Now, what we have seen over the last few decades, contrary to what Francis Fukuyama told us would most likely happen, is we've seen a backlash against democracy and liberalism in general. Part of that may be the success of China and other authoritarian systems that have focused on control at home and hierarchy and maintaining authority. And many countries around the world admire what China has done, and they actually go give seminars and training programs and provide technology for surveillance and other things. But I think the broader wave that I think you're asking about is really about the turn in Western countries. And that started, I think, or at least took a big step forward where we're sitting with Brexit 10 years ago. And so it's come fully to the United States, where President Trump has ridden to office twice now, attacking liberal institutions and views, particularly in his second term, and worked together with a whole bunch of intellectuals and scholars and policymakers and business people to have a very different view of what the United States should be about, what it should be aiming for. And it's very illiberal, whether it's about how they treat society, how you govern it, home politically or how you participate in international politics and the global economy, quite different from where the U.S. was a few years ago. And to some extent, he is reacting to a wave of anxiety, but he's also building on it and making it larger and accelerating those views. He is a political entrepreneur of the first order. That means that our relationship with China, another illiberal system, is not about how can the U.S. use China's integration into the international system and the rules-based order to tame its authoritarian and illiberal characteristics. How can you make it cooperate on a whole variety of issues? How can you have economic interaction, even though the party state intervenes heavily in their economy? How can you avoid military conflict? The answer to all of those things was integration into a rules-based order, and the U.S. isn't seeking that any longer. And so our relationship is based much more on more crude metrics and cruder tools of power. And we're not trying to change China. In fact, we've changed a lot ourselves, and we are not relying on reference to any sets of norms or tool or principles for this. This is really bare knuckles brawling. And occasionally you get things like today where both sides shake hands and reach a temporary deal. So that's type of relationship that the Chinese probably find quite comfortable. No one's trying to change China. The world is now safe for countries like China. And the things that we're arguing over are really small ball for them. And all the competition is on our side of the court or our side of the field. And that's quite comfortable for them. And so we are miles or kilometers away from the kind of dynamic that the relationship had in previous decades.
So what then are the biggest concerns in the U.S. now about China's growth? And what are the biggest concerns in China about the U.S.'s evolving place in the global order?
So I think there are a variety of long-term challenges, just speaking from the perspective of me, what issues that we face, and then there's different ways to handle them. So I think a fundamental challenge that both sides have with each other is how to divide the pie. So China is now a high-tech innovator. They are innovating and manufacturing and selling in the exact same markets as the United States, Great Britain, Germany, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and others. The global market's only so big. How do you divide the pie? Decide who gets what? What is fair? We used to say, we're going to let the WTO decide and tell us what's fair. And then we will have bilateral agreements and domestic laws which align. And then to the extent to which you comply or don't comply, then we know how to divide the pie. The Chinese first undermined those rules, not directly, but all the loopholes that are in the WTO that don't address beyond border behavior and industrial policy. They utilized all of that. And they're a huge economy. So everything that they do domestically has huge global macroeconomic consequences. The U.S. has decided that those rules were simply handcuffs on it, and so they've abandoned those rules as well. And so the question is, how are we going to figure out how to decide who gets what? And if today is any picture of that, we're just going to negotiate item by item. How many soybeans will you buy? How many planes will you take? What about chips? What about this? What about that? No reference to what should be done in terms of principles or whatever. How high can I raise my tariffs before you get too ticked off at me, and vice versa? So that's the first big challenge. The second is we got a bunch of national security challenges between us because the U.S. view about the security architecture in Asia or the Asia Pacific or the Indo-Pacific, pick your favorite term. For the U.S., that has historically been the presence of the U.S. military in collaboration with allies to keep the peace, to be honest brokers, to make sure that war doesn't break out, and to allow for prosperity in that context. China's view is that the presence of the U.S. military and its alliances are the main thing getting in the way of solving the big problems in the region, which for them most principally is unification with Taiwan. You'd also throw in control of the South China Sea and probably a variety of other things. But for the most part, Taiwan's the biggest issue. So we have very different views of that security architecture. And we are preparing each to go to war against the other as our primary focus these days. The third set of issues where we really disagree with each other is everything in between that we've already touched upon a little bit, which is when you've got that complex economic interdependence and you're national security foes, all of that interdependence now looks like risks, and how do you manage them? Historically, there's been no clear rules on how to do so. There have been very few norms. The WTO says, if you have national security worries in your commercial relationship, you can do what you need to mitigate that risk, but don't overly affect commerce. That's it. few sentences. They don't say anything about what do you do about technology, leakage, data security, supply chain resilience, energy security. There's no rules or anything. And so we are just doing this issue by issue, moment by moment. And I think that means everything gets politicized and amped up very, very quickly. The Trump administration has had its approaches to addressing them. The Biden administration before and others, no one's gotten this right. The Chinese have the same kinds of parallel worries, and their solutions aren't necessarily any better. On the first one, who gets what? Their solution is you should stuff it. You should send me a thank you card for being so good at producing 25 million EVs way cheaper than you could, and solar panels and everything else, and say thank you, please. Don't criticize us. And that's not a legit solution. Other countries have car industries, energy industries. They have supply chains. Just simply giving everything to the Chinese simply because they've subsidized stuff and they're pretty good, that's not a good outcome. On the economic security issues, again, they don't have a great solution, which is basically, if you can punch, I can punch harder. And so we need to figure out solutions to these things, and we are far away from doing it. So hopefully the students and faculty of LSE will figure this out very soon.
In your podcast, China Field Notes, you speak to scholars and experts on the ground in China. What insights have you taken from these guests about the current state of U.S.-China relations?
Thanks for noticing the podcast, and I hope some of your listeners at some point after they've listened to every single one of your episodes takes a minute to listen to a few minutes of China Field Notes. You can find it on Apple, Spotify. You can go to csis.org to listen. And just so folks understand, I think fieldwork is really important, particularly in a world as troubled as we are. I tend to believe that ignorance is a bad foundation for policy. And by not traveling, not learning the language, not learning the culture, not talking to people directly, not observing, not doing surveys, you are less informed about the other country. And that is a big challenge. Now, fieldwork doesn't solve everything. You can get misled by fieldwork. You can do interviews and people can lie to you. You can collect certain kinds of data in the field and it misleads you. But I think most folks that look at international affairs believe in triangulation. Use as many methods as you possibly can, and fieldwork is one of those. In Washington, D.C., and in the United States, a lot of podcasts on China. Typically, podcast is one American talking to another American, and one person who's not been to China talking to another person who's not been to China. And I think that that's a mistake, or not a mistake, but it's a lost opportunity. So to fill that gap, our podcast talks to people who either live in China or travel to China a lot and can give people firsthand accounts of what they see. Sometimes that's just research tourism. Sometimes it's just conferences. Sometimes it's just what life is like. And then other times we're talking to people who are doing systematic social science research, like we just had a podcast with Jessica Teets of Middlebury College, who does surveys of local officials recently to understand what it's like to be an official in Xi Jinping's China. And so by doing that, you get a much more tangible, nuanced picture of what's going on in the country. So you cannot pick some of these things up by data scraping off the web or reading Xi Jinping's speeches. If you really want to know, for example, how Chinese people really think about life under Xi Jinping, then you need to be doing surveys of them and asking them difficult questions and ask a lot of them and follow up with interviews and other things. So Scott Rosell at Stanford is a regular collaborator with me. He and some others, including Marty White, who used to be at Harvard, did some great survey work of Chinese views of inequality. And they've done those surveys multiple times over almost 20 years. So they can see how Chinese, what do they think about the fairness or unfairness of the system? And that's just really difficult to pick up unless you're there. When I was there right after the end of stages of the pandemic, I should just say, I believe in fieldwork enough that I was willing to do 26 days of quarantine, in part because I needed some alone time, or I should really say my wife needed some alone time. But I also just wanted to see what things were like. And having not traveled to China for, I guess that was about 2+ years that I hadn't been there, 2.5 years, there's new fashion, there's new restaurants, there's new hobbies. People have new views about their own country, about the United States. And we had missed all of that. And so the podcast is meant to try and provide one sliver of a window into what it's like to be on the ground in China, because it's really important for us to understand China. You want to cooperate with them, you want to compete with them, you think they're the biggest enemy. To be effective, you still have to understand what the heck is going on there.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary, and if you're lucky, you might win 250 pounds in vouchers.
So how can China's efforts to promote domestic innovation be beneficial and destructive to the global economy?
So it's partly different sectors. You get different kinds of consequences for what the Chinese are doing. In some places, it's the same sector with multiple kinds of consequences. I'll just give a couple examples. In pharmaceuticals, most people, including me, really didn't see this coming. Over the last decade, the Chinese have become serious, serious players in the global pharmaceutical industry. And China's had history of major controversies in pharmaceuticals where lots of Chinese have died by taking these horribly made drugs. And its regulatory system is bad. But China's got a lot of smart people who have, by studying and working abroad, studying medicine, pharmacology, chemistry, have learned a ton. And China's pharmaceutical industry is dominated by these people who have lived and worked abroad. And it's grown extremely rapidly. There is some concern that because China is China, that if they're going to be deeply involved in pharmaceuticals and things that we put in our bodies that are really important, they could get access to our data when they do clinical trials or DNA, and that can be used against us. You could think of customized bioweapons. There's other ways potentially could be harmful. I think most of that is sci-fi nonsense, but there's some people who take this very seriously who have security clearances. So I don't just dismiss it entirely out of hand, even though it seems at the edge. On the other hand, if the Chinese come up with cure for cancer, I don't give a that it was Chinese. I lost my mom to cancer. I've lost other relatives and friends to cancer. Everybody listening has had the same suffering experience. We just need better solutions and therapies for cancer and a whole host of other things. And so, and I don't care which pharmaceutical company gets the profits for that and whether it's China that gets the credit or somebody else. And so I think broadly speaking, China's move into pharmaceuticals is, on the whole, a very good thing. But there's other industries where it's more problematic or where it's complex. You take something like electric vehicles. Yes, China's ramped up battery production, produces over half of the world's electric vehicles, consumes many of them, is the world's largest auto exporter. This is helping the world move through the energy transition and transportation. At the same time, China's EV industry has been massively subsidized, and that has put other auto industries in other countries at risk where they shouldn't be, where there needs to be opportunity for them to grow and adjust. And so a lot of countries have responded with tariffs or other kinds of restrictions because of China's growth in EVs, which isn't necessarily the policy that I would choose, but it's totally understandable. And if you look at solar or other industries where China has combined tech and subsidies and has radically changed the supply structure of these industries, it's really hard for everyone else to compete. And that's about jobs. It's about value chains. It's about countries' way of life. And so that is a challenge. Again, it gets back to the question we talked about before about deciding who gets what and how to manage that. We don't have good rules of the road now to address challenges like this.
So based on your work, what would a China-centered global economic order look like if it were to come to pass? And how might it differ from the current US-centered one?
I guess it's first important as a caveat to say there are differences of opinion within China. Xi Jinping has his views, and his view matters more than anybody else's, but not everyone agrees with him. And previous leaders had different points of view. So if you go back to the 80s and 90s, in particular, Chinese really were serious about integrating themselves into the rules-based order and implementing market-oriented reforms and trying to comply with their commitments. I think Xi Jinping, when he was competing to win the top job, there was a lot of corruption in China. China's foreign policy was not very effective. China's economy was still highly dependent on foreign technologies, which is a national security risk. There were the color revolutions in other parts of the world. They had seen the Soviet Union dissolve. And suggestion of folks like me was go all in on reform, change your political system, at least liberalize it more, and that openness will help. Xi Jinping didn't listen to me. He didn't listen to most Americans or Westerners. His solution was to double down on Leninism, to go all in on expanding the party's control across every sphere of life. And we had those WTO commitments, which said more transparency, more compliance with the rules, constraining industrial policy spending. We're not going to do that stuff. We're going to do it our way. And if someone wants to challenge us on that, go ahead. We'll meet in the back alley and we'll do that. And that's a very different order than what we had been building over the last 75 years. China is comfortable with preferential trading arrangements and preferential investment arrangements, making decisions on a case-by-case basis, depending on your economic strength or your political loyalty, how much you help the party, all of those kinds of things. That's an economic order China under Xi Jinping would feel comfortable. Again, previous leaders and many Chinese economists and others don't like that, but that's the order would feel more comfortable. And to their luck, Donald Trump feels comfortable with that order too. And America is not as good in that order, but he is comfortable with it. He's not pushing on them in the ways that others have in the past, where there's been that broader tension. And so we are living in a world where China under Xi Jinping feels much more comfortable. And what used to be a white flag now just looks like a red tie.
So are there any adjustments in policy which the US can or maybe should make to accommodate China's economic and political rise? And this is considering the constraints of the Trump administration's America First principles.
Yeah, I want to push back just a little bit. Yes, China's economy has been growing. They've been coming stronger. But when we say to accommodate China's rise, that suggests a narrative in which China's destined, inevitable to be more successful, more powerful, unless some outside force gets in the way and stops them. I think most of the things that would derail China's continued economic growth and greater international influence are domestic. It is the way the party governs domestically. It is the way they interact with the world, oftentimes not from a position of genuine respect and equality, but looking down on many countries. The way Chinese treat smaller countries in their neighborhood and elsewhere is really a sight to behold and concerning. Oftentimes, I think China is their own worst enemy. I'd say for the United States, oftentimes in the United States, we are our own worst enemy. So do I think, though, that the United States should find ways to coexist with China, even cooperate? Absolutely. We do need to find a balance between finding areas where we can cooperate because it just is so obvious that it's in our common interest because of these are industries where we both benefit from and we're in different parts of the supply chain. We have different comparative advantages. Or there are areas where there are global commons problems where if we don't cooperate, we're screwed. Climate, public health, global fisheries. There's lots of areas where we better figure that out. And then I think there are areas where we have differences where it doesn't necessarily mean that the best solution is just an arms race to make ourselves in a defensive posture. There's ways that we can interact with the Chinese where we are interdependent, where it actually helps our national security. So instead of decoupling or strategic decoupling, I think about calibrated coupling. How can we calibrate the relationship with China in ways that benefits our national security? Just a little example. In artificial intelligence, Chinese are doing a ton. The U.S. is doing a ton. Everyone is focused on it, stuffing a ton of money. The U.S. benefits dramatically from having hundreds of thousands of Chinese students in STEM in American universities and companies helping the U.S. get better. I think at the peak, we had 369,000 Chinese students, but as a result of tensions, we're down to 240,000. That's still a lot. There are very few American students studying in China. We do have a lot of American companies in China, and it's really valuable for them to be able to benchmark what their Chinese competitors are doing in AI by being there. They also might learn from them and get better themselves. They're by being in China and providing certain kinds of technology, you help keep the Chinese inside your technology architecture and ecosystem. It doesn't mean that you provide everything willy-nilly to them. I'm not talking NVIDIA H100 chips that can make that missile really hit home. But there's certain types of technologies where it is better to have them in your system than outside it. And I think that that's the kind of thing where we can look for connectivity in ways that actually benefits us, not just in a cooperative way, but in a zero-sum way. I don't think I want to just tell the Chinese, you know, be interdependent with us because it helps us keep you weak. That's not the argument to make to them. But in some ways, that interdependence does promote certain kinds of advantages for the United States and the West. The biggest practicer of that idea is Taiwan. Taiwanese continue to have a huge commercial relationship with China, protect their domestic local technologies, really avoid, if they can, giving away their best stuff to the Chinese. But they see maintaining that relationship is helping fulfill the goal of what they call strategic indispensability. And so they view that having that connectivity and Chinese dependence on TSMC's ability to produce 90% of the world's advanced chips as creating extremely high costs for China to consider in a war. Some call this a Silicon Shield. I think that's probably going too far. If the Taiwanese were to declare independence, it would be war the next day, probably. But outside of that, that indispensability provides a variety of benefits on the security front. At least that's how the Taiwanese see it. And I think that there's a logic to that. It doesn't mean you should put all your eggs in that basket. So there's ways that we can try and adjust how we manage the relationship with China, either to cooperate or create mechanisms of connectivity that work to our advantage, in addition to needing to have strong military and deterrence in certain areas.
And from the standpoint of countries that might be caught in the middle of the US-China rivalry or competition, what major concerns and risks come with the possibility of a Chinese-dominated global economic order or a China that's very powerful within the existing economic order?
I feel a lot for everybody else. I'm also frustrated with everybody else and how they are dealing with this problem. Many countries, not everyone, but many countries are really worried about the Chinese. They have the same three worries that the U.S. has with regard to who gets what, security issues. Those might not all be in Asia. It may also be about China's role in supporting Russia and Ukraine or other places. And they have the same concerns about economic security. I think a lot of Western countries, traditional American allies, wanted the U.S. to double down on the rules-based order and cooperation with the allies to present a united front with China and also expand economic opportunities to be a better alternative to what China is offering. That's not what providing these days. The U.S. has decided to try something very different, and all of these are quite frustrated with the U.S.'s approach. China is often country's number one trading partner. They can't outright abandon China economically. The U.S. sometimes is their number one security guarantor. They can't abandon them either. And so the typical response is to hedge, to be reasonably polite to both sides and cross your fingers and hope everything goes okay. I really would like some countries around the world to give Beijing and Washington tough love. I really wish folks would say, hey, what you guys are doing is leading us down a very, very dangerous path. And we're not just going to sit here and let that happen. We have agency and we're going to do something different. We're not going to just dissolve our relationships with you, but we're going to try and do something different that tries to protect or reform, improve the rules-based order to deal with a lot of the weaknesses that generated the backlash in the first place. We've seen some efforts at that, but they are usually too far and in between to really make a giant difference. The biggest one that's out there, the biggest tough love action that countries can take is the UK has already done by joining TPP. It is really important if we're going to continue to have an international economy based on rules where the WTO can't fulfill that, that some other institution step into the breach. And the best candidate is CPTPP. I honestly think it would be great to take CPTPP and the OECD, mash them together, and have a much more powerful institution. What needs to happen then, whether that merger occurs or not, is the UK, Japan, all the other members of CPTPP need to go around the world, get other countries to apply and join. Of course, the most important outstanding member region that needs to make that decision is just a few miles away, the European Union. That would provide the economic gravity to CPTPP that would be a serious counterweight to what the US and China are doing these days and will put a lot of pressure on them to modify their own behavior. But we're not there yet. So I'm hoping that folks recognize and have some courage to give Washington and Beijing some tough love.
And just as we finish, I'd like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on that you think they might find to be of interest.
Well, thanks a lot. This has been a lot of fun, and I really appreciate the chance to have this conversation with you and look forward to feedback from listeners. I'll just mention a couple things. One thing that we've done recently and something that we're working on that folks can be paying attention to, CSIS.org. I think I mentioned previously Scott Rosell from Stanford, who's done a lot of really good work with other colleagues on human capital in China and people's attitudes about inequality. He does more field work in China than just about anybody I know, and he's doing it for a very, very long time. Scott and I recently published a piece a few weeks ago in Foreign Policy, a publication based in Washington, D.C., that tries to examine China's complex economy. Why does it look like a tech superpower on the one hand, but a macroeconomic disaster on the other? And why do we think that those two things are likely to endure for a while? And how are they connected to each other? So you can go to Foreign Policy and see the piece and our answer to that question. The other thing I want to mention is a project that we're working on in my program at CSIS about industrial policy spending. In 2022, several of us teamed up for a report that estimated how much money China spends on industrial policy across many different tools: outright subsidies, tax breaks, cheap credit, land, cheap electricity, government guidance funds, etc. And we also did the same math for seven other economies. That report was called Red Ink. It got a lot of ink in the press and government's paid a lot of attention to it. We're working on the successor to that called More Red Ink, and hopefully by the middle of 2026, it will be out there and we will be able to update our numbers post-pandemic. And given that the U.S. had the Chips and Science Act and is walking away from free markets, we expect the U.S.'s numbers to rise some, but we need to actually just go ahead and do the math, and then we'll decide how much industrial policy spending is actually occurring, how effective is it? Is it actually helping countries innovate? Is it creating problems? Should we come up with some new rules or principles that manage all of this government intervention in the economy? So please stay tuned for More Red Ink.
Thank you. And our listeners should look out for that. And we'll be providing links to all the publications you've mentioned and your China Field Notes podcast in our show notes. Just remains me to say, Dr. Scott Kennedy, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Kennedy is Senior Advisor and Trustee Chair in Chinese Business and Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Scott Kennedy for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/United-States. On X and Instagram, we're at LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're at LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Avan Fata. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at lse_us. And tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.
Play ball!